by an electron. The surface would have to be moving faster than the speed of light. We can't do it. No quasi-classical picture of an electron as classical surface stuff works. Quantum mechanics stuff. Quantum mechanics, quantum field theory, these things we're studying have not been falsified. Classical mechanics has. There are things that classical mechanics predicts on a couple of fronts. The general relativity, Maxwell's equation, just like Newton's theory of gravitation, predicts no effect on light. Well, we can measure light coming past the sun and see that it's deflected in agreement with general relativity. And so, in that sense, Newton's theory of gravity has been falsified. Not that it's a bad approximation to what happens. We know it's really good for this kind of thing. But that it can't be the ultimate theory, because we know of situations where it's just flat out wrong, where it makes the wrong prediction. And that's true of classical mechanics. Vis-a-vis quantum mechanics, which doesn't face that contradiction. People test physical theories all the time and work very hard to falsify them. The theory makes a prediction, you do the measurement, you see if what happens actually agrees with what the theory predicts. If it doesn't, you need to tune up your theory somehow.
So why is most of the physicists working on quantum mechanics, or quantum field theory, or quantum gravity, and if they know that it's classical mechanics, it doesn't work?
Because quantum theory does.
Yeah, but why are they not trying to fix
quantum mechanics? Is the fix, right? They did this a century ago, right? Between about 1900 and 19, what's the Schrodinger equation? 26 to 27. In the first 30 years of the last century, people started to realize there were contradictions with classical physics, and they fixed it. And the fix is what we call quantum mechanics. And so since that time, any fundamental physics has assumed some relationship to quantum physics as a better starting point. Then you find some contradictions with quantum mechanics. For example, the hyperfine corrections we looked at the other day are something that happens because it has to be relativistic. So you make a relativistic quantum mechanics. And if you look at the second order corrections of special relativity to, say, the Dirac equation, and you turn it into a Schrodinger-like equation with second order corrections, you find that those don't agree with experiments. And this forced people to correct quantum mechanics by developing quantum field theory. Quantum field theory has been modified by introducing ideas of gauge interactions. In the last century, two new interactions of nature were discovered. At the early part of the century, only electromagnetism and gravity were known. By mid-century, there was a strong nuclear interaction and the weak interaction. And those two, as well as electromagnetism, came to be understood starting in 1930 with Hermann Weyl as gauge theories. So gauge theory technique is a way of systematizing some of the things we do in quantum field theory. It's not a change of quantum field theory, but it's a summary of the right things to do in field theory. That's probably a better way to say it. It's been realized since around 1970 or so that we can understand all of the known interactions of nature as gauge theories. And three of them are well understood, as quantum field theories. the electroweak interaction. I say electroweak because those two have been unified demonstrably. There are predictions that come from the unification that have been tested and found to hold. So the theory is predictive. That together with the Chung interaction, we have a fairly satisfying way to treat those with quantum field theory that have been subjected to many, many tests over the last 50 years and haven't really fallen down at all.
How is quantum field theory related to the standard model?
To the
standard model.
The standard model? The standard model is a gauge theory of the fundamental interaction. So the idea is that the electroweak interaction is based on the symmetry group U1 cross FU2. The strong interaction is based on FU3. So from those two groups, FU2 cross U1 and FU3, we can construct gauge theories, which when we quantize them using the standard techniques of quantum field theory, make predictions about three of the four fundamental interactions. That's the standard model. So the standard model of particle physics is the gauge theory, FU2 cross U1 together with FU3 for the strong interaction, quantized using any of various techniques of quantum field theory, which they agree. There are different ways of implementing quantum field theory, but they agree. So you quantize the gauge theory based on those symmetries, and you make predictions about the interactions of fundamental particles. All known interactions of fundamental particles, including which ones we see, can be understood on the basis of those interactions and six quarks and their antiquarks and the six leptons and their antileptons. So that picture is the standard model. To that, one wants to add gravity because that's the other known force besides those three, two. And there are some more or less successful models that bring gravity into that picture. Those are called theories of everything. So a theory that tries to contain the standard model within some more unified picture is called a grand unified theory, GUT, a theory which tries to bring in gravity. It's called a theory of everything. That's TOE. So, toes and guts. Okay. So, good. Does that help?
Mm-hmm.
So, if you want to contribute to fundamental physics, what you want to do is take as a starting point the standard model and general relativity. Because those two theories have been tested often to as much as, I think the Erdős experiment is probably the best experiment in the world. They're just about, I think that's up to something like a part in 10 of the 15th now. Certainly things like the fine structure constant, this is something that doesn't even exist in classical physics, but it exists within QED and it's been measured to 12 significant figures. So the precision which with some of these measurements that they made is mind-boggling.
That binary pulsar, do you know about that?
The Cygnus X one?
Yeah.
The first one? Which one?
I don't remember which one. Maybe it is. I don't think it was the first one.
The Cygnus X one has been tracked for about 35 years.
This is the one where they're doing. They have like GR tests now to almost 12 significant figures. I think as well.
This binary pulsar, you've got, there are several of these now, and as they track them for decades, you get extremely good orbital data on these things. what you see when you've got something like a pulsar orbiting a black hole. Pulsar is a great clock, so here you have a perfect system to study gravity in minute detail. You've got a clock that's sending this pulse to the Earth every so often with very high regularity.
How do we know that these pulsars are rotating? How we do make the difference because the rotation and who can say that it's rotating?
I think that the prime motivation for saying that is the regularity of the pulse. These things send out pulses as fast as once every millisecond, and the regularity of the arrival of these pulses is reproducible. It's unchanged for decades. Right? They're extremely regular. The simplest explanation is you've got a star, a collapsing star, that is producing a beam of radiation that is somewhat directional. So it's this cone of radiation that comes out. That's natural for a collapsed object because it has a strong magnetic field, and that would collimate particles and radiation that are escaping from the surface of things hot, right? So it's going to radiate stuff out, but it's natural that it would radiate along this strong magnetic field. Magnetic pole, not the North Pole rotation axis. We expect it to be rotating, so the picture that emerges, and there are detailed relativistic calculations to bear this out, that this cone of radiation is going to sweep around the sky like this. Well, if you're Earth, and it sweeps past every millisecond, you see this flash of radiation with great regularity. Angular momentum is beautifully conserved in both quantum and classical mechanics, and so the regularity to be understood.
What if you say chop a beam?
What if what?
Chop a beam.
A beam chopped so there's someone out there blocking it?
It's the same.
We see them all over. We have an explanation for the existence. I think that's the thing that makes the initial hypothesis that this is due to directional radiation from a rotating object makes good sense. Okay, but now we see hundreds of these things, and we've done a great deal of theoretical work that predicts the existence of neutron stars and pulsar. We now believe is a neutron star that happens to have this radiation and rotation pattern. Neutron stars are at this point well understood. We see these things. We can see their crust, shell, settle. We can see a number of properties that agree with general relativistic predictions of a star of that size and mass. So, in detail, we can look at the structure of these stars based on the radiation patterns from them. We see them in all directions. We see them in numbers that correspond with how many of these things we might expect to see. We've got a better model, but there it is. Something that chops off the beam, what would do that? Alright, okay, so if you have a bright object and there's something big in orbit around it like this that blocks the beam. That blocks the beam for a short time and you see it for a long time. It's not a short pulse followed by silence and then another short pulse. It's a long pulse and then it's occluded briefly. So an orbiting body that acts like a beam chopper can't do it. Can't do it. The proportion of pulse to dead time is wrong. But a directional beam that swings past you does work. So the radiation appears to be focused rather than going every direction and being blocked. I suppose you might have a a ring with a gap in it. That's not a very stable structure. Very hard to imagine a classical system of any sort that could do this. Partly to mention quantum systems and physics.
But we haven't made any experiments to prove.
Well, oh, sure we have. But, well, only 40 or 50 years worth. When was the first pulse, I think? 50s, maybe? 50s. So, 50 years of experiments on pulsars, probably. Don't underestimate what we've done. There's been a lot of experiments on it. We should talk to, you know Shane Larson in the department here.
Mm-hmm.
His wife, Michelle, works over at the provost office. She did her dissertation on the structure of pulsars. She can tell you a great deal about the structure of these things and probably do a better job than I can of bringing you up to date on what experiments have been done, what results are really known. These things are very well established.
Well, what can you know? You've got the periodicity. You've got the amount of flux that can be sent out in these cones. So you know about how far they are. So you know how much energy.
Yeah, they're actually the radiation curves. You get the whole distribution of energy that's radiated. So you can know that. You can know the mass if it's in a binary system. You can figure out mass parameters. We see star quakes. Once in a while, we'll see a pulsar. Disrupt its period and suddenly shift to a new period, and then it very quickly settles into a slightly faster period. What's happened is the crust has settled. These things have a very thin, very thin, like a centimeter crust. gravity here is close to black hole gravity. These things are really massive. But that crust can settle, and you're spinning, you pull in your arms, you turn faster. Well, it turns faster and suddenly the pulse rate goes up just a niche. And we see that kind of thing. And have models that describe it. The original picture for neutron stars, which is due to Chandrasekhar, who got a Nobel Prize for it when the stable group. So we got the Nobel Prize in 1986 for his prediction of neutron stars.
50 years.
Was it 50, 30? Yeah, I was that. Yeah.
Takes a long time for the Nobel Committee to.
Usually, you want to see experimental verification of a theoretical prediction. They don't generally give an award in physics to a theoretical physicist until the prediction has been tested and found to agree with experiments. So, for example, Weinberg and Salong, who were primarily responsible for the electroweak model, the Fe2+U1 electroweak model, formulated that theory in about 1970, and it wasn't until 1980 that they received the Nobel Prize for their work when the predicted particles, the W and Z particles, were measured and found to have not only the masses that the theory predicted, but the decay width, the half-life, that can be measured for these particles and agrees with the predictions. And have another detailed predictions from the model agree once you fix a couple parameters in the theory, you make concrete predictions that bear out. So at that point, when they saw the Z naught or the W part, I forget which was seen first, then they received the Nobel Prize. So Chandrasekhar, Subramanian Chandrasekhar, received the Nobel Prize for his prediction of neutron stars in about 1986, give or take a year. And that was based on satisfying evidence of their existence. The scientific community, and in particular the Nobel laureates and others, the ones who actually vote on to get surprised that people were satisfied that these things really exist. And, well, that was 20-some years ago now. But there have been lots of studies. The Cygnus X-1 has been studied for decades, and detailed orbital parameters are available on that. The test of general relativity that I think is most striking, though, I don't know. Is it the radiation range that is not subject to that precision?
It's the Shapiro effect. So the one I'm thinking of, I think, is different than Cygnus X1 because I think it hasn't been seen for as long because I think the biggest thing is that the orbits of these things are like 8/10 the speed of light, both of them, in the binary system. And so you have...
Are they only both pulsars?
Both pulsars. Yeah. And so you have the timing is good for both of them, and then you're getting the basically the effect of the light ray passing through the gravitational field. So when one is going... When they're like right next to each other, you can get the pulse of the one as it passes by the other one.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's just like this perfect system. It's actually in a plane. The plane is so that we can see it perfectly in this plane. So.
That's great. Yeah.
I think it's the Shapiro time delay of that that is the...
So the time delay, if you have a photon passing through a strong gravitational field, the actual propagation time is different than passing through empty space. The space is curved, so you've got to go further. One way to see it. But also, there's a time dilation effect. Does that show up? It might show up in the frequency, but not in the arrival time. The Shapiro effect is time delay, the actual arrival time of the place. The experiment I was thinking with Cygnus X-1 is the measurement of gravitational radiation. We have not directly detected gravitational waves. That is, just like electromagnetic radiation, light or heat or ultraviolet, infrared, you have gravitational radiation. Because of the nature of gravity, it's not dipole radiation like an antenna, it's quadrupole radiation, so you have to have a bit of motion of some heavy masses to produce it. But a pulsar in orbit around, say, a black hole is a good radiator, and you can look at the decay in the orbit because you track the pulsar in its orbit, and you get Doppler shifts, things like that. Frequencies you get, you can tell when it completed an orbit. And you look at the orbital period, and it changes. Well, why does it change? Newtonian gravity doesn't predict any change in an isolistic orbit, nice clean system, but general relativity does because you have gravity waves. Gravitating bodies can radiate energy, and so the system is losing energy. And the pulsar falls a little bit closer in as it loses energy. Falls closer in as it radiates energy. The rate of energy radiation from the system agrees in detail with the prediction of radiation from general relativity. And so you have an increasingly good test of the predictions about radiation by gravitational bodies from the pulsar. It's not going to be 12 significant figures, I don't think, but it's definitely, what would it be now? A few percent, a few thousand, parts per thousand, I suppose. It's a sensitive measurement, but it's well within the experimental error.
Wouldn't in falling matter create a problem?
It's a very clean system. It would. But you would also know if there was a substantial accretion disk. What you've got is a very clean system because it's a pulsar around the black hole.
Oh, so the
chunk
is being
swept up. Yeah. Or blasted off. If you had a pulsar in orbit around a regular star, it'd be schlooping off stuff and it'd be a really nasty system.
Right.
So that's not what you want. But a big thing when two pulsars in orbit or a pulsar in a black hole,
and
two black holes can detect radiation. Now, you don't see a whole lot of stuff. You do see radiation from accretion disks around black holes. Stuff does fall into a belt around the equator and fall in.
But it's not enough to affect the rotational...
It's comparatively tenuous, and it's probably a lot closer in than you would find a pulsar orbit. I mean, this pulsar could be orbiting at, say, the orbit of Jupiter or the orbit of... it could be a half a light year away and still be doing a very stable orbit, so it would be well away from the accretion disk around the black hole. Binary stars, well, how close do you have to be a binary star? If we were in a slightly different stellar system and Jupiter ignited, Jupiter doesn't, I think, produce some heat, but something 13 size, times the size of Jupiter is a round dwarf star. So if you had a situation where you actually had two stars about that distance, or say twice that distance, that were big enough to collapse to a binary pulsar, then, okay, you're, say, the distance from the sun to Pluto, the sun's not going to have much accretion disk out of Pluto. There's not going to be much stuff there. Planets, before the stars collapse, planets would have swept up most of the stuff anyway.
So any non-conservation of angular momentum is going to be attributed to the gravitational radiation?
Gravitational radiation, starquakes could be, there could be a rare impact with something. If you had a very, something of comparable mass to the pulsar colliding with it, it could change things dramatically. But you don't see very big changes. What you do is you model the system, and you track it for any sudden changes. That's going to be something else. That's not going to be gravitational radiation. You're looking for a steady state loss of energy. So that rate should be potentially constant over decades. Any sudden change should trigger something else. These are great questions. You know, we should have hours where we talk about whatever comes up. Interesting.
A primer on Hamiltonians.
I promised Hamiltonian mechanics
in four and a half.
Do you understand Lagrangian mechanics?
Started to.
So if we start with the action as the integral of L dt, you're okay with this.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that if we choose L to be, for example, T minus V, then the Euler-Lagrange equation gives you the second law.
Yep, it should be d by dt of L.
It would be this, right? And this, if this is the half m x dot squared minus some potential x, then this is going to be d dt of, all right, partial L with respect to x dot, it's just m x dot. Minus the only x dependence is here, so it's going to be plus dvdx. That's minus the force. So we get gdt is f.
Okay.
F minus dvdx. So one dimensional case, but you can easily upgrade it. So this is the basic way to get classical mechanics out of the variation.
Is there often a type in there, or is it just...
In here?
Yeah.
Well, there isn't often one. Those tend to be dissipated systems, but you can put it in there and treat dislocated systems as well. Sure, sure. There can be explicit time. If there is explicit time, energy may not be conserved. So, you can put it in. It's fine. So, what Hamilton was able to do was to introduce more symmetry into this problem by doing a Legendre transformation. L is a function of, let's just say, x and x dot for simplicity here. And it's possible to define momentum to be the partial of L with respect to x dot. It's actually a generalization of mx dot. If you have some more complicated Lagrangian here, you could have anything for a Lagrangian and still do the classical mechanics of it. Then instead of mx dot here, you get something else. But that something else is always something that you would feel comfortable calling the momentum conjugate to this position x. So you can think in terms of a pair of variables, x and p. It's conjugate in familiar ways. This Lagrangian formalism doesn't have to be in Cartesian coordinates. It could be in any coordinates at all. This is a generally coordinate covariant formulation of mechanics. And in that way, it generalizes Newton's law, which is. But suppose our variable here was an angle. Then the conjugate momentum would be the corresponding angular momentum. Things like that just work out right. So there's lots you can look at there. But Hamilton performed a Legendre transformation that takes functions of position and velocity into a new function that depends on position and momentum. Well, that doesn't seem like much as p is just mx dot, but in the general case, it can be non-trivial. Well, how do you do this? The trick is to define the Hamiltonian to be the momentum times x dot minus the Lagrangian. This is the standard trick due to Legendre, which allows you to interchange variables. You may have seen it in thermodynamics if that's ever taught anymore. But notice that if I take this expression and differentiate with respect to x dot, here I get p, here I get dl dx dot, but that's the definition of p, so that's identically zero by definition. So h doesn't depend on x dot. Well, it is going to depend on p, especially when I can invert this and solve for x dot as a function of t. I can replace all the x dots that appear in this expression. So, for example, if I've got l equal 1/2 m x dot squared minus d of x, then h, well, let's find p first. P is dl dx dot is m x dot. So h is going to be px dot minus l, but that's just mx dot squared here, minus 1/2 mx dot squared plus v is 1/2 mx dot squared plus v. But I have to think of this as momentum, so I write p squared over 2m plus v of x. And we notice that that's the total energy. So when the Lagrangian does not explicitly depend on time, the Hamiltonian is the conserved energy. But this gives rise to a new variational principle. Here, we vary this expression with respect to x. And x, all the x dots induce some transformation that we integrate by parts, and we get the Euler-Lagrange equation. Instead of that, we can write px dot minus the Hamiltonian, that's L, right, dt, but now This is Px dot minus h that depends on p and x only. Here, Hamilton did something different. He did not just vary x. He varies x and p independently. So you think of this as living in a bigger space called phase space, where the coordinates are x and p. So instead of a one-dimensional problem, now we have a two-dimensional problem. Or instead of a three-dimensional classical mechanical problem, we have a six-dimensional phase space where this dynamical system lives.
So it doubles the dimension?
Doubles the dimension. Right. Look what happens when we vary this expression, but we're going to vary x and p independently. So we get del p x dot plus p del x dot minus partial of h with respect to p times the variation of p minus partial of h with respect to x variation of x. And we treat del x and del p as independent variations. Did you follow it? You got that?
I think so.
Okay.
It's just the product. I see how you expanded that, but you're treating them as independent.
Yeah. So I could have done one or the other. I'm doing them both at once here. But suppose I could hold del x 0 and just do del p, or I could hold p 6 and just vary x. So I'm going to get two equations here. For p, here's an x dot minus dh dp. For del x, I have to integrate this by part, because that's an x dot. So for that, I'm going to get minus p dot del x, and then I have this term minus dh dx del x, all integrated dp. So the coefficient of del p has to be zero, and the coefficient of del x has to be zero. We get two equations now, and they are simply x dot is dh dt, and p dot is minus dh dx. These are Hamilton's equations. They reproduce Newton's second law as well. So, if we take this example, the Hamiltonian is p squared over 2m plus b, then this is going to give us x dot is dhdt. Well, the dhdt is p over m. We've recovered p equals mx dot from the first equation. From the first equation. The second equation uses p dot. That's minus the partial of this with respect to x, that's minus dv dx. So that gives us Newton's second law. And we recover the relationship between p and x dot. This is pretty typical. It can, of course, be much more complicated looking, but you gain something here. It turns out that by treating x and p symmetrically, you've introduced a much larger symmetry into the problem. And that symmetry can be used to solve the problem. In fact, the symmetry is so big that by doing just transformations that preserve these equations, you can transform to a system where the Hamiltonian vanishes. These transformations are generated by generating functions. And there's a particular generating function called Hamilton's principal function. If you use that to generate a transformation of these equations, it transforms to a new Hamiltonian and a new x and a new p, say a q and a pi and a k. Same form for the equation. Q dot is partial of k with respect to p. Pi dot is minus partial of k with respect to x. But if you use Hamilton's principal function to do that, k is zero, so the motion is constant. So by finding that principal function, you have potentially major problems, mechanical problems, trivial. And now you just undo the transformation from that trivial solution and you've got a complete solution to your classical problem. They went on to derive a thing called the Hamilton-Jacobi equation, which is a differential equation that allows you to solve for Hamilton's principal function. It's the lowest order approximation to the Schrodinger equation. The equation, unfortunately, is nonlinear and terribly difficult to solve, so it's not a very practical method of solution. It is a powerful analytic tool, though. You can show a lot of traits that classical mechanics has by looking at the Hamilton-Jacobi equation, and in fact, it provides the closest approach of classical and quantum mechanics. Okay. There. Was that 4.5 minutes?
Yeah, that was perfect.
Okay.
Here, I'm done with the first quarter.
Okay. Oh, by the way, all the notes are up.
Did you find that missing audio file? No.
No, did you send it to me?
No,
you said
like October 27th. That was a
26th. Or, oh, 27th.
That was a Thursday. Yeah. So,
yeah. There was a funny date in there. But let's see. So do I have that audio file?
I don't know.
Take a look, guys, and see if you can find mistakes, like the wrong audio file was the right day or something like that. Or the right audio file was the wrong day. Either one. See if you find anything that doesn't come up. I've also linked our group meeting. We have the ones that from that. That's linked through the seminar button. So go to the notes page on the field theory class, and where it says seminar in the box on the notes page, that will take you to not only Tedian and Ferenc's, at least one of their lectures, but our last week's thing we didn't follow through on Wednesday, but we'll next week. Do you have other stuff from Tedian and Ferenc?
Yes.
Because Kevin really wants to know when that's up.
Okay.
So,
yes,
it's 8 hours to get all that stuff up.
I know that for one thing that Devin did, there was no audio because I didn't have a recorder. Yeah. For one lecture, there was no audio. But, yeah.
Best we can do is put up what we've got.
Okay.
So when you get a chance,
okay, yes.
I'll update that page.
Okay.
I haven't put any notes on the seminar page, actually. But the stuff that leaks there, and you can look at your pictures of what happened.
Yeah, so it's all here, yeah.
Okay. So, let's see. What next? We haven't really quite finished this basic thing. I think doing this in detail is probably a good idea. By the way, I'm thinking we haven't moved all that fast with this class. We were just getting quantization, so if you guys want to, we can continue next term. Does that work for you?
We're talking about that too. Anyway.
I think just keep on pushing on with this until we actually cover some ground. I'd like to see what Maggiore has to say about quantizing non-abelian gauge theories, for example. Yeah, so let's get to that. See what he says. So, the normal ordered Hamiltonian is given by the integral d3t. Is there 2 pi here?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Energy dependent upon T times AT dagger AT. Those are operators. This is the normal ordered version where we've now got a rule. Every time that we're going to have an operator ordering dilemma in going from classical to quantum physics, the rule is normal order. So, provided you can express the quantities in terms of creation and annihilation operators, which you can for Klein-Gordon solutions, but all of the field theories that we've looked at, right, scalar field, Klein-Gordon equation, Finner field, satisfies Klein-Gordon equation. Satisfies Rett, satisfies Klein-Gordon. Electromagnetic field, box A equals J, Klein-Gordon equation, everything's a Klein-Gordon equation. Maybe no math, but we're always looking at something that where a Fourier expansion is going to work. So far, for all the field theories we're dealing with, we're not going to have any problems implementing our normal ordering rule. So, now, we want eigenstates of H. So, we want some states energy eigenvalues. And the trick to this is the same as the trick for the simple harmonic oscillator. What you do is you fuss a while with this operator. You notice that A dagger A is a positive definite thing. Okay? If I look at the state chi and act on that with the operator A, this is some other state, let's call it psi. Well, the inner product of the ket with itself is positive definite, zero only if the state vanishes. So, if I note that the bra corresponding to psi is just going to be the bra from chi acted on from the right by a dagger, then I have 0 less than or equal to chi a dagger a chi. But that has to be true for all chi. So the eigenvalues of this thing, if chi is an eigenstate of this thing, it's got to be positive, right? If A dagger A acting on chi is chi times chi, then this says that 0 is less than or equal to chi times this normalized thing, which is just equal to 1, so chi's got to be positive, not negative. So there is a lower bound for eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian. Well, we're used to that with energy, so that's cool. Let's suppose that, here's what we can do. We use the lowering operators. You okay here?
Yeah, okay.
Suppose we have one eigenket, H alpha equals alpha x alpha. So suppose we have one eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. Consider, what do we consider? If the Hamiltonian acts on this new state. So, A acting on that is A dagger A alpha. And we have a commutation relation for these things. I suppose this is really the Hamiltonian density. that thing. I should give it a name. We should call it a number density operator. So it's really bad that I'm trying to find some eigenspace stuff. So these things will come out to be densities, but other than that, we'll be okay. Now I have a commutation relation for this A and A dagger. Anybody remember what it was? A dagger was one, right? A delta. So P and P prime, we had delta 3 of P minus P prime.
It was like a 2 pi cubed or something.
2 pi cubed, yeah, that's right. So here we're going to get, I can write these two as a dagger. So this minus that is this. Which way does it go? So this is a dagger minus a dagger a. So a dagger a is equal to a dagger minus 2 pi times the delta. And we still have an a left acting on alpha. So this first term is a times the number density operator acting on alpha. The second term is minus 2 pi cubed del 3 of b minus b prime times what? A acting on alpha. Well, this just pulls out an alpha and gives us that get back. So what we have is this alpha times A alpha plus, or minus, sorry, this operator. All acting on A alpha. And now, to get the energy, we integrate all of this over d3p, that integrates out this delta function and the 2 pi cubed, right? We've got the 2 pi cubed cancels here. The delta function is just going to give us E of p. So the Hamiltonian acting on A alpha is going to give us alpha comes out, and then we get the delta function, so we get alpha minus 1 times the thing is big. So once we integrate over d3p, or d3p prime. So what happened is the eigenvalue of the Hamiltonian has been lowered by 1. We can't do that forever. Why? Because it's got to have positive definite eigenvalues. This procedure lowers the eigenvalues of a given state. So, finding any one eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, we can construct more. And we can keep constructing until what happens? We get down until we're some number less than or equal to 1 here. And then the next time we act with an A, we get a state that is annihilated by the Hamiltonian. The only thing that happens is you can get 0 and then you can't do the process anymore. So you find that there must exist some state that is annihilated by the Hamiltonian.
Up until what you were just writing.
Yeah,
I'm through with that.
You're good. So, there exists a state 0 such that A on that state is 0. And we can't apply A anymore. Can't apply the lowering operator or the annihilation operator or the mode amplitude operator. Lots of names for A. But we can't keep applying it anymore.
Why did you change from N to H?
Remember that. This is just an integral d3p of
you really like the definition
and times the energy. So it gets rid of the delta function, exactly. Yeah, this alpha, since it's a density, this alpha probably contains a delta function too. But what I wanted to suppose about alpha is that H gives alpha. So H legitimately gives alpha here, and then the 1 comes from doing the integration. I switched mid stream between the Hamiltonian and the density, but you can definitely see that this is lowering the energy. So we're going to have to hit 0 sometime. So now what we do is we define the state. Where we act with a dagger on some action. And now we run the argument the other way. When we act on this state with the Hamiltonian, should I do it carefully this time? You want me to do it carefully?
Okay. I would like you to be careful.
So let's act on this state with the Hamiltonian. That's equal to the integral d3t over 2 pi cubed times A dagger, I hope we've got EP in here, EP, A dagger, A, acting on A. Let's act with some A plus Q here. Dagger. And then act on the draw. We can rearrange. Which ones do we want to rearrange here? Probably, yeah, those two are the ones that are going to give us something. So, A dagger is the same as A dagger of Q, A of T. Let's see, plus this time, 2 pi cubed delta of T minus Q. Just using the commutator again between A dagger and A. It comes the other way around because this time we've got A on the left. So, integrating. Are we ready to integrate yet? Or let's break this up. We have D3T over 2 pi cubed EP AP dagger AT. No, sorry. This is two, yeah. AP dagger, A Q dagger, AP, acting on 0. Well, that is enough because it's actually A acting on this state that's got to annihilate it. So any AP acting on this 0 state is 0. And we can make that argument for any P. If we'd gone through this part, keeping P's and Q's separate, we would have seen that. But exercise, go back and put in the P's and Q's and the integrals on the first part of the calculation. What happens here is this is 0, but we have another term. We have the integral d3t, because the 2 pi cubed cancels. We have EP, then only the AQ dagger. Only the AP dagger. Acting on 0. And a delta function. P minus Q. Sorry to work myself in the corner there. So, coming back over here. Everybody good here? Did you have a question, Jeff? Can you see what I've written there? So we now have two terms.
What is that AP acting on the 0 cat? Go to 0, and it didn't go to 0 before then?
It wasn't acting on 0. Back here, it's acting on a dagger acting on 0. So, you can't say that that's 0. It's only when A acts directly on the zero test that you get zero. These don't commute. So now we use the commutator to get the AP to the right so it can act on zero, and it kills it. But we picked up this extra thing. That's this term from the commutator. Well, we integrate that extra thing. We just do the P integral. It changes T to 2. So finally, what we get is H acting on AQ dagger acting on 0 has to be EQ times AQ dagger acting on 0. So now we have an eigenstate with energy EQ.
Cool.
Now we know how to build an eigenstate with any EQ we like for any momentum, any free momentum too. Well, here's something that differs from the simple harmonic oscillator, because we can act with any A dagger. We have a whole slew of them. The same thing happens for any number of A daggers acting on a state. You act on any state with A dagger, and it gives you a state with energy increased by EQ. Any number of these things. So, for example, we can construct a state AQ1 dagger, AQ2 dagger, up to AQN dagger, acting on the vacuum. And we could label that state by Q1, Q2, up to Qn. And we would find that the energy of that state over the base.
It's the sum of all of these.
It's the sum of all the E's.
Right.
So the sum of E1 through E. The interpretation of this is that the zero state is a vacuum. It's got no particles in it. When we act with an A dagger, we've created one quantum of the field with energy EQ. If we act with a product of a whole, these all commute because they're all daggers. If we act with a whole bunch of A daggers with different Qs, what we get is now N quanta. So we have a state containing N quanta of the phi field with energies E1 through EN. And momenta Q1 through Qn. So this is how we create discrete particles.
Why don't they have different energy?
Because we acted with different Qs, right? Remember, these are mode amplitudes. We started with A is really a function of the free momentum. In the Fourier expansion of the solution to the classical equation, these are just the mode amplitudes of the Fourier transform. But now they become operators in the quantum field theory, and they act just like raising and lowering operators, but we have a lot of them indexed by momentum. We have one of these operators and a dagger for every possible three momentum. So we can act with as many of those as we like. They all commute with one another. This is an unambiguous expression. And if we act with a Hamiltonian, we'll get the sum of energies corresponding to those cues that we acted with.
Can they be the same? Can you have
sure. You can have as many photons as you like in that state, right?
Yeah.
These are bosons. No problem making as many as you like. When we quantize the Dirac equation, however, we'll find that those dudes anti-commute. And that will prevent us putting two Dirac particles of the same in the same state. But I think that it's worth going through all that in detail. First, to really see the necessity for the anti-commutation relation, we need to talk about mass and charge. Remember, we derive the energy operator for the Klein-Gordon field, and it was it was a sum of two things. It was the sum of the number operator for the particles plus the number operator for the antiparticle. Now, there's no charge for a simple Klein-Gordon field. We had that fine ambiguity. We sorted it out later. I remember it because I put it online. but it was a sum of two terms, and I wasn't sure if it was plus or minus, so we went back and we checked, and we found, oh, that should have been a plus back there. Okay, the energy is a sum of an integral of a sum of the particle number operator density plus the antiparticle number operator density. They both carry positive energy into the future. If we calculate the conserved current of a charged scalar field, how do we charge a scalar field? We give it a U1 invariant, so it's got to be complex. So we look at the complex scalar field, which we'll do after we're done this, and it has a current. That current turns out to be the charge times the number density, integral of the charge times the number density of particles minus the number density of antiparticles, because they have an opposite charge. So you can unambiguously identify the charge operator and the energy operator. Now you do it for graph particles. And those things come out with the wrong sign. The energy looks like the difference and the charge looks like the sum, and that's not what it's supposed to be. Unless you introduce anti-commutation relations. And so you can get the energy and charge relations to work out correctly if you impose on spinner fields anti-computation relations instead of computation. So we'll actually gain some insight into why these Dirac particles have been anti-computed and therefore satisfy Jeremy Dirac statistics instead of Bose-Einstein statistics. It's a direct consequence of making sense of the field theory. So I'm not sure we can do a whole lot more with the simple scalar field, so we should move on to the complex scalar field. We're going to run out of time. We're probably going to have time. When do you have to go?
4:30.
Okay. Yeah. So we can press on a bit. You said you had to go at 4? Okay. Check your notes online. It's the same construction that we've done here, but now we've got a complex scalar field. So where we had a Fourier expansion that had an A and an A dagger, now we're going to have an A and a B. They're not necessarily going to be the same.
Question. In some ways, when we introduce a complex scalar field, we introduce two fields, the field and the conjugate. And we say, when we take the, before when we were varying it, we varied it with respect to either of them independently.
Mm-hmm.
What is the analogy between, here we only have one particle. So it makes sense that even if this thing had a charge, we wouldn't necessarily see it because you don't see the consequences of something having a charge unless there's something else with a charge. So if we introduced a scalar field with two particles in it, would we get something that was...
Oh, we can do, yeah. There's one with n particles, right?
Okay.
We can have as many quanta in this field as we like. Those are particles. So we can have n particles of our real scalar field with momenta 1 through n, and none of them will couple the charge. Why? Because when we gave the theory to get electromagnetism, we looked for a U1 invariance, and there is no U1 invariance of the scalar field, of the real scalar field. So we go ahead and make the whole thing covariant. Well, there's a weight in this covariant derivative. The covariant exterior derivative of some field phi, if we're talking U1, is d phi. Plus, really, there's a constant here. There's a constant that tells you what the charge is, but it's always in one charge. Then we have the vector potential times phi. That becomes the covariant derivative, where, well, this characterizes how many charges you've got. It's zero for the real scalar field. So we don't have to write a covariant derivative for that action. And there is then no coupling between A and the real scalar field phi. So you go ahead, you do the electromagnetic gauge theory, and okay, you've got a bunch of real scalar fields around, none of them have charge. No matter how many quanta.
And no interaction between the scalar fields.
Not via photons. Okay. They don't exchange photons.
Okay.
So they may have some other.
So avoid that, you have to introduce the complex field.
You have to introduce which?
Complex
scalar field? Yes. If you write the action for a complex concordant field, then you have a phase invariant. If you change that field by a phase, it drops out of the action because you write a real action. Well, let's write it down. You ready? So let's look at the action for the complex scalar field. And it will couple to electromagnetism because we introduce electromagnetism by gauging U1, making U1 a local symmetry. And so the global U1 and global phase invariance, the term like this, and then the second term, phi star phi. This has phase invariance. We can multiply phi by a phase. It's conjugate gets the opposite phase, so that term is invariant under a global phase transformation. When we gave that U1 symmetry in some huge Lagrangian for the world, right, we have all the particles we ever want to see, including photons, then these particles will couple. You'll have to use a covariant derivative here with the A mu in it as well. And that will give coupling terms like phi star, d mu of phi star, a mu, phi, and it's complex conjugate. Those terms will show up when we replace this by covariant derivatives. And that corresponds to a coupling between phi and phi star and a. So you do see these things absorb in a mid photon on account of the presence of vacuum. So, let's push on here. What do we do next? We need a solution for this, right? We have a solution. So, what did we find? Probably a similar integral, right?
It makes all the same.
So, if it's A and B,
if it's A and B, or is it A and B dagger?
A and B dagger.
Okay. Minus I, P dot, actually,
that's yours.
Plus B dagger. We could call it either one. It doesn't matter whether we call this B or B dagger, except it's really going to muck up our notation later because then B will be the raising operator and dagger will be the lowering operator and we'll just have the wrong name on things. They'll still be daggers of one another, but it ends up being this one that increases the number of B-type particles. So that's the way we wanted to find it. And the conjugate field, if we need it, is just the conjugate of all that, B3B, B9 cubed, root 2BP. Now we get an AB dagger, e to the I, b dot x, plus bp, e to the minus I, p dot x. So notice this has, if we just interchange these two terms, phi and phi star, or phi and phi dagger, I should call it now since it's an operator, just have A and B interchanged. The role of A and B has of these lumps here. What we want to do is solve for these mode amplitudes just like we did before, construct the Hamiltonian, find an expression for the conserved charge itself. So for the real scalar field, we found the conserved energy, the Hamiltonian. Now we're going to have two conserved quantities, the energy and the charge. So we'll find both of those once we construct the appropriate creation and annihilation operators. So how did we do this before? We took some integral times e to the I q dot x, and we integrate d3x, I suppose, right?
Yeah.
And that's going to undo the Fourier transform. And over to d3d, d3x, over 2 pi cubed root 2 et. Then we have a of p e to the minus I p minus q dot x plus bp dagger e to the I p plus q dot x. And we can do the x integral, and that gives us delta function. So we're left with d3p over root 2ep. Delta function is going to cancel the 2 pi cubed. So we'll just have an a of p delta 3 of p vector minus q vector. Then there's an exponential in the difference of the energy. But the difference in the energy is zero, is that's going to go away. So we don't have a time factor on this. Is that right? Well, it's time to delta, so that it's going to go away.
Last year you're saying t equals zero. Let's start everything at t equals zero. Yeah.
We're going to set t equals zero in the end.
Okay.
So maybe we should not worry about it. What I'm saying, though, is the time piece of this dot product is dp minus dq times t, and then we have the t minus q dot x stuff, all of that. But since it's multiplied by a del 3 of t minus q, those two energies are equal, so the factor is going to go away anyway.
Oh, okay.
So it's not going to be here. It will be here over here. I'll write it just so we know that. You get a dp dagger. You get a del 3, this time, of t plus q. The two energies are the same, so we get a 2i dt or eq equivalent like times t if we want to let the time be something non-zero, which we don't. But then we do the integral. And we just get that root 2p. Is that right? Was that there before?
Yes,
it was. So we have integral of phi e to the I q dot x d cubed x. Equals 1 over root 2 qt. Quantity a of p, or becomes a of q, sorry. Since this depends on q, I better use q everywhere. Plus the dagger of q minus q. Times e to the 2i d q t. So we get something like that. And we can take t equals 0 and not be too concerned about the result. Now, we need another of these things. If we do the same thing with phi dagger, what's going to happen? Remember what I said, the A dagger and the B have exchanged places. So I can just put a phi dagger in here and conclude the same thing for the same integral. All I have to do is interchange A and B on the right side. So now I have B of Q plus a dagger of minus q e to the 2i e to the 2t. So I get something like that. And I can write the conjugates for these two things by, let's see now, how can we solve for these? Quite as easy now. We need the momentum, right? That's the thing. We need to do the same thing.
Oh, phi dot. Phi dot. Oh, okay.
Yeah. So what's pi? It ought to be the partial of the Lagrange density with respect to phi dot. And that kind of thing. What is it?
It's phi dot again. No, no, okay.
That's phi Geiger's. Because, right, the zero term here is phi star dot phi dot.
Uh-huh.
If I take a derivative with respect to phi dot, I'm going to get phi star dot.
Oh, okay, okay.
So, this ends up okay. being phi Geiger dot. Well, what's its conjugate? So, phi dot. Okay. Yeah.
No. Right. Yes.
No. Yeah. Keep saying done until we get it right. Okay. Sorry. What's your? How about the engagement? Why this happens? If I write this action out, this is d zero. Right. This runs 0, 1, 2, 3. So 5 star, which is what I'm calling dot. So I get the 2 time derivative term, the phi star dot phi dot plus, well, minus because of the signature space time, grad phi star dot grad phi minus m squared phi star phi. So this is the Lagrange density. If I take the partial of the Lagrange density with respect to phi dot, I'm left with phi conjugate, which as an operator becomes a dagger. And then, if I take the dagger of that relation, I find that the conjugate field to phi dagger is phi dot.
We'll still get this even in the gauge version, right? Even with the gauge.
The gauge version, yeah, would be the same.
Okay.
That's right. Okay. That's not going to change the conjugate. This is something that happens in ordinary Hamiltonian version of Maxwell theory. The conjugate momentum to x is actually p minus a.
Oh, okay.
Right?
Oh,
it's
okay.
The momentum minus the vector potential. So you get the same thing in the gauge theory. Because there's a cross term.
Right. Yeah.
So if I got here, we'll have the minus a plus a zero.
A little different.
We'll see that happen. Let's see, is there a... I guess it's just a time component that shows up in that. Yeah. So, conjugate free momentum. Where's that happen? Yeah, let's see the classic thing by Hamiltonian means. You'll see it. P minus A kind of thing emerging. Okay. Anyway, let's sort these things out. We have, which do we want to do here? If we look at the conjugate momentum, we're going to have phi dagger dot. So we get a time derivative of this thing for pi. We have our f of the 3. We have d3p over the usual normalization here. 2 pi cubed root 2ep. And then the derivative with respect to time is going to pull down an iep 3. So, IEP
times all of this stuff over here, it pulls down a minus sign, so we get a relative minus sign.
You have to put a minus four. Yeah.
So A dagger, B to the I, C dot X, minus B of C, B to the minus I, C dot X. So that's our pi dagger, minus four right here. It's going to be the dagger of all this. What's that going to do? We'll pick up a minus sign here. We get this interchange, but that fixes the minus sign on these two. So it actually ends up looking just like the same sort of interchange we had before. Let me write it. So here we're going to get a minus sign, but then that's going to become a plus. So if I interchange these two terms, I get a minus sign there as well. So I'm going to keep this as a plus I e to the c. But then I'm going to pull the bc, e to the I, c dot x, to the front, minus a bp dagger, sorry, ap, e to the minus I, c dot x, like that. So, we're good on the sign. Then we need the Fourier transform of these things. So we have some integral right over here. Pi e to the, what do we want to pull out here? Here's pi. I'm going to pull out minus bp, if I can say. So if I multiply by I2 dot x and integrate b3x, what I'm going to get will have this ratio of energies. We're going to have a delta function as before, and we'll just do the d3p integral. The 2 pi cubed cancels, but we retain this I dp over the square root of twice dp, that factor. And then there's this minus sign. That's actually good. We had a minus on that I before. So this minus sign, then I'm going to have a b. I've integrated over the delta function, so everything now depends on q. So we free up this b completely, and the time part goes away. Then the a part comes in with the minus sign. We have a dagger 2. A dagger, sorry, minus q, e to the twice I eq t.
It's between two boards, so I
yeah.
I gotta zoom out, yeah. Okay.
And finally, I dagger, e to the I, q dot x, three vectors, e three x. It's going to be, okay, so what's different between these? It's just an interchange of A and B. So same expression with A and B interchanged. Minus I EQ over root twice EQ. Quantity A Q minus B dagger of minus Q E to the 2I EQ. Like that. And hopefully this gives us enough stuff. If I add the first and the fourth, for example, that's going to isolate a. So we can solve for the raising and lowering operators. We just have four equations now instead of two. So we don't want to try and write that. And click the little tie over here and make a speckle. Get rid of quite that. So this Q equals what? Alright, in that first register we're going to want to multiply by a root 2 equals Q. Then we have, what I want to do is add these two expressions, the first and the fourth. The B terms, B dagger terms will cancel, the time dependence will drop out, so we don't have to worry about it. The only thing I have to do is invert this pre-factor and multiply. So I'm going to have 2 eq times the integral phi e to the iq out x dq dx. Let me go ahead and write that, iq out x dq dx. And then I'm going to add to that 1 over that pre-factor, so plus root 2 eq over minus I eq times the integral of pi dagger e to the iq x dx. So we've isolated the one. And let's see about making this a little prettier. Let's just combine all these terms. There's a common factor of root 2 eq. Then we have phi, let's call it plus I over eq times pi dagger, and then we have the exponential and the integral. So that gives us A. We should be able to find a dagger just by taking the dagger of that. So what happens? We have root 2 eq by dagger minus I over eq pi e to the minus I q dot x eq x. Then, let's see, we probably need to do the same thing for B. And it'll work just the same way. We add the second and third equations over there. This time we're going to have phi dagger plus the factor times pi. Other than that, everything looks about the same. So, D sub Q, and is that what we think we're getting? B, yeah. It's going to be integral, we'll have this twice E2 to the 1/2. And then the phi comes in now as a phi dagger. Then we're adding I over EQ times, which is just pi. So plus I over EQ pi. That's good. The sign is different than A dagger. So each of these is an independent combination. Then finally, E to the, what is it, plus IQ dot X. D3X, and finally D2 dagger is immediate, 2EQ, phi minus I over EQ, phi dagger E to the minus I Q dot X, D2 dagger. And those all look nicely symmetric and cover all the possible linear combinations of all four possible field things, so I think we're good. Now we just have to set up a commutation between any pair of these that we want to figure out. Use the canonical commutation relations of what? What are the fundamental commutation relations now between the fields? The fields and the conjugate domain.
Right,
now elaborate pi, but remember that pi was
Well, it doesn't matter. It's between the phi and the pi. So the conjugate momentum, the phi is pi, even though it happens to be phi dagger dot. It doesn't matter. Because we'll write it in terms of the and not the conjugate variable. We just have to remember what the commutation relation. Pi with pi. Those are canonically conjugate, so one of these depends on x and the other on y. So let's say phi of x and t with pi of y and t equal sine, we get I del 3 of x minus y. It's just IH bar, right? We integrate that over all y, we get momentum, we get 1 on the other side, no factors of 2 pi here, is that right?
Right.
Okay. Then the phi of x commutes with phi of y, pi of x with pi of y, write it this way. So pi with pi is 0. And the other fields don't care about each other either. So we have similar things for phi dagger with pi dagger. That's going to be pi del 3 of x minus y.
Not minus, not minus y, actually.
Seems like there ought to be a minus I there, right? Is that...
Can we just take the conjugate of the first conjugate?
Yeah, looks like we can. The, all right, let's be careful. Okay. Any questions in my comments? We'll look. All right, the commutator of pi with pi is pi, pi, minus pi, pi. And I want the dagger of that. That's, right, the dagger of this is pi dagger, phi dagger, that's minus phi dagger, pi dagger. We get a minus sign. It is minus commutator of phi dagger with pi dagger. And we can't take the conjugate, that's equal to minus I del 3 of x minus y. And so that's right. I like that. Well, phi commutes with phi dagger. Phi commutes with pi dagger. The two fields don't know about one another's conjugate momentum, for example. Those go through. So the only non-vanishing commutators are between the field and its own conjugate momentum. So let's see what that implies. Maybe we should add another mark. I was listening to some of these video things. There are long, silent gaps while I erase and write. Look, do you guys find those useful? I mean, I suppose while you're staring at the slide, it might be just listen to what's happening. They do actually synchronize pretty well. Let's do the slide. I haven't been able to check everything I... Now, how many things was it like? Over 100 different slides you sent me. What was it? Nine days worth of slides, 20 to 200. 20 slides and 10 different video files and... Plus, that's not counting the ones from the seminar.
Oh.
They had another 40 slides and two videos. Oh, I spent all day yesterday getting that stuff online. So I do hope you guys find it useful.
But they used to do it once and for all the other picture classes, it's all up there. Yeah,
okay. Yeah, well, you do a little bit of it. Remember Rome. Little bricks. Okay. Let's see what this implies for... What, A with A dagger? If we take the commutator, oh, nice.
markers, yes. A, Q. With A, dagger, D. We should be able to figure this out. It's all of that stuff with all of that stuff. And we've got to keep track of the type of using Q. So we have a whole mess of integrals here. Let's see. What do we got? We've got D cubed X and D cubed Y, because we need different integration variables in the two things. We're going to have a square root of 4 EP EQ. Then, for, let's see, we also have these exponentials. So, E to the I, which is Q dot X, plus I T dot Y. So I'm thinking of AP being expanded in terms of Y, and AQ being expanded in terms of X.
Is it a minus IPY?
Could be. Where are we? Yeah. Looks like minus. Good. Then we have a commutator. And for A, that has 5 plus I over Q. I'm high as dagger. Yes. And then it's just a dagger of that. And it depends on P. This will depend on P. So we have a phi dagger minus I over P, and we have a pi. So we got it. So this is good, because there's a phi and a pi, and there's a pi dagger and a phi dagger, so we actually get something non-zero. That's encouraging. Looks like we might be on the right track. Anything other? No, I think we're good. So, what? What does the engineer say? Plug and chug? Find this pi is an I delta. We have a minus I over EP, and we have an I del 3 of X minus Y. That's the phi pi commutator. Then phi phi, we're also going to get a minus sign because these are in backwards order. It's phi to pi. So minus I over EQ, then I del 3 of X minus Y. That's good. So we have this common delta function. This all looks pretty much like it before. The I's go away. The signs are all positive. We can integrate over Y. I've lost the exponential. Where'd the exponential go? We might want those eventually. I P dot Y. So, either I Q dot X minus I P dot Y. And the first integral over the delta function sets X equal to Y. So we're left with D cubed X. We have root 4 EP EQ. We're going to have 1 over EP plus 1 over EQ. And we have E to the I Q minus P dot X. We integrate that, it gives us 2 pi cubed times the delta function, del cubed of Q minus P. And then all of these energies become the same. So we end up with 2 EP, let's say, from this, times, what are we getting up? We're getting 4 here. There's a 2 here and there's a 2 here. That gives us 4. One of these things canceled. 4 ET. That doesn't seem right. We've lost some factor. There's E again. We did this before, right? Mm-hmm. So, where were you guys when I was doing this? How do you get off? Is this the kind of attrition we had the other day with the root 2 E2 and 1 over E2? No.
The last time we made a mistake, we had a 1 over square root of 2 E2.
So this is much better. Now we've got 4 of them in the numerator.
Right.
Hot diggity. We're doing great here. why are we seeing these things?
There's some algebra there. One is that the E is gone, for sure. It's square root of E over E.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, square root of E squared over E.
Yeah, okay. So that E is gone. Yeah, square root of that, we get it. So we get 2 E here, we get 2 over E here, so the E's canceled, but why are we getting
4?
4. Should we have normalized all this differently? I mean, I suppose we could have taken 1 over the square root of 2 times all of this to be our A and A dagger. I'm not sure why we would have done that. No, these were the solutions.
Right.
So where could there be a factor of 2? Ah, got it. I see it. Anybody else see it?
It's supposed to be on the bottom right now. No.
All right. When we solve for A, we add 2 equations together. That gives us 2 times 5. Right. When we were doing a solution, we had the 4 equations over here for A's and A daggers, or for a linear combination of A and A daggers. So a certain integral of phi was a combination of A and pi or something. We added 2 such equations, we get 2 times A equals the sum of those integrals. So we have to divide by that 2, so there's a half in front of each of these. So these equations have each a half. We computed each of them the same way.
Oh. So you put a half on the book, I'll let you from 2.
Oh.
Yeah.
Then making no difference here, but by the time we get over here, we have 2 factors of a half. And 4.
Okay.
Good.
Look at
that. You know, one of these things, there were like 4 pictures of the same board. I got like 2 copies of each slide.
I realized in the last one, I take more than one because sometimes they come out blurry. But I realized in the very last lecture, I didn't filter it out. I forgot to do it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I usually try to choose the best one too.
it was no problem once I realized that I'd gotten duplicates all the way through.
You should make one of those bar games. You know, they put the 2 pictures up in the
But you know, that's great. I do. You know, I toggle back and forth, and I see if some little thing has appeared between them. Because often that's the case. You'll take your flight. Now I toggle between those two, and halves will appear. Make that guy in the future shirt jump in and out of the picture. Stuff like that. Okay, exercise. Show the same thing for the P. Find all the commutation relations.
So this, you're going to have to go through tonight.
Yes,
so
I'm going
to try and wrap it up. The what was I thinking about the photos? I get to choose the best. Oh, I know what I was about to say. Is to get these things in my mind, the first thing I do is I go through and I change the name so that the name of the file has the date and all the identifying material. So I went through this double list. Normally I just give them all the same name except A, B, C, D, E, right through the list. I got up to Z, A, Z, B, C, 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 C. No, third. Usually I get up to M or N or S maybe. So it seemed like a new record except for the G. I think I actually legitimately got down to W one day. this is a clear stopping point. So, any questions?
What does this result mean?
Well, it means we once again have raising and lowering operators for the complex scalar field. The AP dagger will create a state of momentum P from the vacuum. And we apply it as many times as we like with as many different P's as we like, and we'll create quanta of momenta P1 through Pn. And we can annihilate those with the A. And you see this when you actually do something like a path integral and look at the interaction terms. We're going to expand the interaction terms of these A daggers and A's as well. And what's going to happen, coming into an interaction, you imagine this thing acting on some state. What happens? Suddenly, that state is hit by an annihilation operator and some particle disappears. Then you get some interaction thing, well, vector potential thing. So suppose we've got this thing coupled to EM, and we've got a term in the action that looks like a phi dagger and an A mu and a phi. Well, we expand that all out in terms of A's and A daggers for both fields, and there's going to be a term in there where you've got starting from right to left. You've got an A for the phi field, you've got an A dagger for the photon field, you've got an A dagger for the phi field. What that means is you start with a state, you annihilate one quanta of the phi field, you create one photon, you create one outgoing phi. So that's just this diagram we've been drawing, where a phi comes in, emits a photon, and goes on. You see it all in terms of creation and annihilation operators acting on the vacuum, or acting on whatever state is coming in. And so these are what's going to turn those interaction terms in the action into those Feynman diagrams we keep drawing.
Can we do this too with the Dirac equation? Or does this
We're going to do this with the Dirac equation.
Okay.
Oh yeah, you bet. it's a little hairier with the Dirac equation. It's not too bad. Of course, the conjugate momentum is weird looking and stuff like that. It's also the conjugate field, and there are gamma matrices floating around the ship that fuss with. But you just go through, you do the same thing, and you find the commutation relations, and you find the conserved energy and the conserved charge. You identify particles, antiparticles, and try and make sense of it all.
These fields are spin one. Yeah.
Spin zero. These are scalar fields still. Spin one will be when we do E and F. So we look at the A and U. Now, we didn't solve that, did we?
What is it?
We need to solve the free Maxwell equation. We didn't express vector potential in terms of Fourier notes.
Right.
But we can. It's still the Klein-Jordan equation, so we'll just write Fourier notes. The difference is it's a vector field you're expanding, so you have some vector coefficient in these modes, the way we had some spinner in the Dirac field mode. In E and M, you're going to have an A mu. Well, we don't have a Fourier transform now, but instead of phi, you've got four of them to this vector. Well,
What are those vectors? There's a polarization vector of, you know, the E and B field. So they give the direction of the E field, essentially. They're orthogonal to the propagation because E and M waves are transverse waves. So if the wave is moving in the K hat direction, K hat dotted into the polarization vector is zero. So there's really only 3 degrees of freedom left. But also we've got this gauge condition that a zero vanishes, so we don't have a zero component for those vectors, and they're transverse waves. So they're orthogonal. So there are only two polarizations left after the gauge reduction of the electromagnetic field. Well, we know that because we all have polarized lenses. Right? There are only two polarizations for the electromagnetic field. It's because of gauge invariance that you see that. So we'll go through all that. Alright, so that's kind of what I mean.
Good job, by the way, matching the book today. Your outfit and the book.
Oh, great. Well,
I think that's a picture of you.